Murder mystery. Real natural law. Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's hyper thinking. Welcome to the Crypt.
The Secret Kindergarten is here for the young children of the world. The best program on the radio for kids. Dealing with the most important topics in the whole universe. Fairy tales, music and movement, numbers, plants, animals, fun, colors, insects. Take care and cast your ears out to catch a story from the world of other young things. Reach out, up, under, and over. Sing a song. Talk about feelings. Just remember the magic word. The magic word is no. Step on into the Secret Kindergarten. Saturdays, 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Revolution Radio.
What the heck is the truth, Jihad? Hey, I'm Kevin Barrett, host of Truth Jihad Radio. Federal prosecutors, Department of Homeland Security agents, and curious passersby often ask me, just what is this Truth Jihad thing anyway? Well, everybody knows what truth is, but jihad is a misunderstood term. Jihad means effort or struggle. The greater jihad is the struggle to be a better person, while the lesser jihad is the struggle to defend the community. Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, did say that the best jihad is a word of truth flung in the face of a tyrant. And that's what we do here at Truth Jihad Radio. Every Friday, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, 5 to 7 Pacific, right here on Revolution Radio.
Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. This is That Rabbit, but not for public consumption. Ho, ho, ho. Did you know that in Turkic, gobble, 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 is actually ho, ho, ho? Well, anyway, here we are at Revolution Radio on a Thanksgiving morning. We hope everybody is happy, and I wish everybody the best of Thanksgiving and a lot of food and all that good stuff. And remember, we're user-supported, so support us when you can. And I say hi to everybody. And rather than get off into the world of craziness, I'm going to hop right into something, and I don't know how far I can get through it. Maybe the whole way, but this is so good, I want to share it with you. This is another story out of Tales from the Blue Stacks up in Donegal, Ireland, Ulster. Or I should say Donegal, Ulster, Ireland. But anyway, this is entitled Marauder. Check this one out. One morning in the years before there was an Irish Republic, Peter Kennedy stepped out of his whitewashed stone thatched house on the side of a rough and heathery hill. The summer sun was already high and an almost cloudless sky, even though by the clock it was only 6 a.m. And Peter, just out of bed, had not yet put in his teeth, and his pink gums showed brightly as he yawned and ran his hand over his still disorganized gray hair. He had put on his black tweed trousers, but not his flannel shirt, so that his ragged suspenders rested on the shoulders of the yellowed woolen undershirt he never went without every day of the year, winter and summer. And the very top of his thin but sinewy and powerful torso and neck could be seen where the opening of the undershirt left a wide space of chest and shoulder bare. That space was a smooth, almost sickly white by contrast with the rough texture of his neck and face, colored less by the sun, which was rarely seen in those hills, than by the wind that blew almost continually, perhaps even by the spitting rains. On this morning, there was no sign of rain. It looked like the best spell of summer was coming on. It was late July. Peter thought it might be wise to cut a section of the park, as he called his meadow, and take advantage of the almost sure spell of dry days ahead. His eyes ran along the meadow grass from its lowest point near the small swift stream 200 yards below him, and so, carefully speculating about the condition of the grass, slowly upwards to the fence above the house that kept the sheep on the mountain and out of the fine inland grass saved for hay. Then his eyes paused and then moved more quickly upwards along the rough, boggy heather of the hill. His face fell into a position of complete relaxation that in him indicated the same onset of concentration that would be marked in a city man by a gesture the exact opposite, a drawing together of the features to mirror the inner intensity of effort. If anything at all indicated that Peter's mind was occupied with a problem, it was only that his small, narrow eyes were a shade wider open than they had been, and his erect body and his hands were very still. He remained in that attitude for less than a minute, then turned without visible preoccupation and went back into the house, where his sister had rekindled the fire from the turf coals that had been buried in their own ashes the night before, and on which the kettle was beginning to steam. Peter now set about shaving, an operation he never omitted, even on the busiest of harvest days, and the thought of getting his tea. His sister would make her own tea, but not his. It was not a matter of enmity, just habit. They always ate separately, Peter at the table, his sister rocking herself forward and back on a low stool by the hearth. As he sat down to his cup of tea this morning, Peter saw the early sun shine off the feathers of the hens pecking before the house, and he thought again of the meadow and of the new scythe he had bought the week before. "It looks to be a good one," he murmured to himself. Then he remembered that something had caught his attention as he had looked at the steep hill above the meadow ground, or, more accurately, the absence of something. For at that hour he would expect to find a number of his sheep not far above the meadow fence, where he had seen them settle down for the night not many hours before. They could have moved over the hill to the far side in the early light before he had risen, but with the wind from the east blowing directly onto the face of the hill, they would suffer less from early midges on the near side of the hill. The complete absence of sheep was odd enough to make him decide to put off all other work until he had gone out to look over his flock. "Hiya, Wally. How you doing? Happy Thanksgiving." "Thanks. Yes, I needed it." When Peter had finished his tea and bread, he crossed himself rapidly, put on his tweed cap, pulled a charred briar pipe, the last inch of mouthpiece broken away from one pocket, and from another a penknife with one polished, worn blade, and a plug of hard, dark tobacco, from which he began cutting rough chunks. These chunks he rubbed against the base of his palm, stuffed the pipe, and lit it with a coal from the fire he held in an old pair of iron tongs. Then he spat into the fire and sat so, smoking and looking at the fire, spitting at intervals, saying nothing to his sister, and not apparently absorbed in thoughts of any importance. In fact, he was not much concerned about the absence of the sheep, for anything could have put them over the hill, too many midges, or a stray dog wandering by, perhaps. At any rate, he would soon have a look at them. His old briar pipe produced a thin whistling sound, so hard did he draw on it to keep the rough tobacco lit. And when he put another coal to it and drew rapidly with his breath, the moisture in the bottom of the pipe bowl gurgled noisily. Finally, he got up, put his chair back to the wall, away from the fire, and went out. At the far end of the house was a small shed, not more than 4 feet high, of rough stone without mortar, and with a slanting roof of rusted, corrugated iron sheets. He loosened a bit of the wire that held the crude wooden door shut and spoke softly to his dog. "Poor fly, poor fly. Come out now and take your tea." When Peter had fed the dog a breakfast like his own of tea and bread, the two set off together up the hill. He knew he could be away until nightfall if he wished, for his sister would attend to the cows and the hens and bring in a heavy creel of turf as well as he could himself. It was not so in the past. For years before his sister returned from domestic service in the town, he had lived there alone and had done all the work of the farm and all the chores of the household himself. Everything from the heavy labor of dipping sheep to the feminine tasks of washing and mending. "I have no one, only myself," he would say when the matter came into conversation. The hardest part of it those days was that he could never leave the farm for more than 12 hours. The cows had to be milked regularly and the hens closed in securely at night. Excuse me. Safe from the badgers and foxes that often stole down in the heavy mists of the long summer evenings. In the winter, the animals had to be foddered and watered. And even after only a few hours away from the house, the fire would be out when he returned. Now his sister saw to all that, and he often spent whole days on the hill, returning only by the last of the fading light, or even when there was a moon, well after sunset. Yet he would not have been afraid to be caught by darkness, as he was often by the heavy mountain mist, for he was sure he knew every yard of the ground by heart. As Peter slowly climbed the hill now, a heavy ash plant stick in his left hand. That's a shillelagh, by the way. Shillelaghs are made out of blackthorn or ash. And the ones made out of ash are called ash plants. A heavy ash plant stick in his left hand, and his dog near him, trotting ahead and then turning and waiting for him. His mind went back to the problem that had presented itself earlier, the absence of the sheep. He did not think there had been midges out there on the moorland out there that morning to chase them over the hill. But the rough grass on the moorland over the crest of the hill was sweet at that time of the year, especially after a clear night when it had been touched by a light summer frost. He would see them soon, he thought to himself. He was near the crest of the hill and paused to look around. About 200 yards distance, near a low sod dike that divided his land from his neighbor's, he caught sight of a ewe. She was standing beside an overhanging bank of turf, and that had kept him from seeing her sooner. Instantly, even before he could think the words, he knew that the ewe was not right. She was standing quite still, facing the bank of turf, neither grazing nor moving her jaws as she would be doing as she were chewing the cud. Peter began walking toward her slowly. She was a 4-year-old ewe, a good rearer of lambs, with plenty of milk. And this year she had a strong ewe lamb with her, born early in the middle of April. He was still well distant when he saw the ewe shift slightly. She had noticed him coming, and now he saw that she was standing stiff-legged with her right foreleg set slightly but awkwardly forward. Peter's mind leapt swiftly ahead, reconstructing the night's events. Something had happened to the flock. That was clear. He would know the whole story as soon as he got to the ewe. He hurried his step, but his dog, as if in confirmation of his intuitions, suddenly fell back and, moving backwards and forwards over a short path several times, settled down into the rough grass and refused to follow. Only as Peter came up to the ewe did he see the lamb close in to the bank, lying on its right side, its legs stiffly out before it, the left foreleg slightly raised in the air. Apart from the stiffness, it could have been sleeping. There was no sign of injury. The ewe backed off a few steps and stamped one forepaw into the ground. It was meant to be threatening, but only had an effect of petulance. Peter contemplated the scene for a moment without moving. Then he turned away and looked again over as much of the hill as he could see and far down into the valley below. Slanting lines of smoke were rising above the thatched roofs of the whitewashed stone houses. On one farm, two children, a boy and a girl, were chasing the cows home to be milked. On another, the hens were being fed. His eye rested on every flock of sheep, and all were grazing normally, without any sign of trouble. He looked over his neighbor's land carefully and back over as much of his own as he could see, searching for another sign or hint, but found none. Then he went back to the lamb. Bending over from the waist, he put his hand to the lamb's neck just under the ear and separated the wool. Two small black holes confirmed his thought. It had been a dog that killed alone, and unlike those that sometimes ran out in pairs or small gangs, this dog did not kill for sport, but for blood. I knew then that the one that did it would be back again, Peter said when he was telling the story later. A dog that kills to suck the blood is not like another that tears the sheep and leaves them. That one will go out in twoses and threeses and always to another place. But this one will always go alone. Isn't it great, too, how he left all the others and picked only my sheep? All in all, he found four dead lambs that first morning, each with two holes in the neck and the blood sucked out. He judged from their condition that they were not long dead. The dog had come sometime in the morning. Over the hill, his sheep had moved far off from the house, off westwards, and were huddling in clusters in close to banks of turf or large overhanging rocks. Two ewes were lame, but none showed signs of having been caught by the dog. Some were not grazing even yet, and some of the ewes had been separated from their lambs. Peter spent the rest of the day going over the whole of his land and beyond it into the neighboring hills if he expected to find any of his sheep there. It soon became clear to him that only the sheep near into the house had been selected. The distant ones were still grazing quietly, looking up and bleating to their lambs as they became aware of Peter's approach, the lambs themselves running swiftly over to their mothers and suckling anxiously for milk. The larger lambs were big now to the point where they had to bend their forelegs and go down to the joints to get their mouths under the ewe. Then, as the ewe felt the lamb get its first suck and establish identity, she would walk a few steps off, pause to let the lamb fall in behind her, and then move off again, But Peter stayed as far from them as he could and kept his dog in close to his heels. He had no desire to disturb the sheep. By late afternoon, he had seen all his sheep and had made sure that the separated ewes and lambs had come together again. Then he went down to the house, got a spade, went back up the hill and buried the four dead lambs. Other farmers, he knew, would have put poison down near or in the dead lambs, leaving their bodies where they were, hoping the killer would return to them. But he himself never used poison. He had seen birds lift it and drop it in other places, sometimes near houses, and good dogs had got it and been killed that way. Besides, he was sure that when this dog returned, and he knew it would go for live sheep only. When he returned to the house, he found that his sister had set out on the table a plate of potatoes that had been boiled and ready hours before, and which she had kept warm in a large round-bellied iron pot by the side of the hearth. A pitcher of milk stood on the table, and a small salt cellar. Peter ate the potatoes in silence, taking large, slow mouthfuls. When he was finished, he boiled a small tin pot of tea over a few coals raked to the center of the hearth, and then he repeated the morning's routine with pipe, knife, and tobacco, and sat there thus, smoking and spitting into the fire, and from time to time relighting the pipe with a bit of twisted paper made into a torch. The wrapping of some parcel of food brought from the town ignited at the hearth. His sister sat to one side and slightly behind him, as always, but not rocking now as she usually did. She sat still, her wrinkled hands out flat, palms down on the city apron and soiled dress that covered her legs to well below the knees, waiting. Peter knew for him to tell what had happened. They seldom talked, but she had watched him take the spade into the hills and had been waiting outside when he returned. He knew that the reason she was sitting so still was because she was waiting for him to speak. "That dog come a long way," she said in a high, thin, singing voice. She was over 70, and her native Irish had left a strong mark, too, on her way of speaking. When he had finished telling her about the sheep, "Did I not tell you the other day, watch the sheep?" His sister often claimed foreknowledge of events. It was true, he remembered. She had said something to him 2 or 3 days earlier about the sheep, and he had seen her the day before looking toward the hill. But she said many things, as often wrong as right, and he had learned not to pay too much attention to her warnings. That night, Peter tied his dog to his own bed and put down an old sack for her to sleep on. It was, for the moment, unnecessary, he thought. The killer dog was not likely to return so soon, but when he did, there was a chance his own dog would let him know. That night his sleep was not disturbed, nor for several nights afterwards. Then he began sleeping less soundly, waking from time to time and listening in the total stillness of the summer night around his house for some stirring or some restlessness of his dog under his bed. One night, after about a week after the loss of the lambs, he rose in the middle of the night and went out. An almost full moon showed him the sheep resting or grazing quietly on the hill. Finally, when 2 weeks had gone by, he thought it was time for the dog to return, if it was going to. And when he saw his sister looking for a long while at the hill that morning, he knew her thought was like his own. Now he began to stir more in the middle of the night, but still no dog came. Another week passed, and he awoke one night in the darkness to a sound, something between sniffling and whimpering, from his own dog underneath the bed. He lay still and listened. The dog had dreams sometimes, and gave out little stifled barks and whimpers, as if she were fighting or gathering in unwilling sheep in her sleep. This time the dog was awake. "Hush, you fly," Peter whispered, and got out of bed. Quickly pulling on his trousers, he went to the door and out in his bare feet onto the broad flagstones that paved the area before the door. A sliver of moon gave a pale light and he could see the sheep moving rapidly in a flock, with the faint, almost not visible form of a dog moving swiftly, agilely around them. They were heading up the hill. Peter went back into the house, pulled his flannel shirt over his head, adjusted his suspenders, and pulled on a red home-knitted pullover. He touched his sister's shoulder to wake her, but she was already awake and turned her head slightly. "When you have the fire made, take Fly and see about the sheep," he said. Then, taking his jacket from a wall peg and putting his cap on his head, he told his dog to lie down and went out. His problem was to get the killer dog away from the sheep quickly before it could do any harm, but alarming it as little as possible. He meant to follow the dog to its home if he could and claim the price of his dead sheep. He was barefooted, as often at that time of year, and could move faster than with boots. Still, it was not easy following a dog. A dog, he knew, could travel 8 or 10 miles in a night and could always outpace a man. And he was not a good runner. He had never been fast on his feet. He went everywhere at a steady walk. Luck would have to be with him if he was to follow this dog all the way. But he also knew that the dog would probably take a roundabout route home, especially when followed, and he had a chance of gaining on him then, for he knew dogs and their ways. These thoughts had been gone over many times before, and now, as he hurried up the hill, over the fence that divided hill from meadow, over the burn, past his shut stacks of thatched turf, all that was in his mind was to reach the sheep before the dog had actually closed in on them. He kept westward as he moved upward, going towards a place where the dog could push the sheep against overhanging banks of turf and hem them in. But as he crossed the smooth, rounded crest of the hill and a vast, flat basin of marshy land and stiff red grass, gray then in the pale moonlight, opened before him, he saw he had been wrong. The dog had not pushed the sheep back to the steep banks of rock and turf. Instead, he had them in a tight group and was moving around them, not fast, but attentively, alert, setting them moving, lunging towards them, working them, confusing them, waiting for the moment when he would close in on the first straggler. Peter thought he still had time, that no sheep had yet been killed. He watched the scene for only a part of a moment, then he whistled softly, a low, short, easy whistle, not very loud. The sheep lifted their heads abruptly in the direction of the sound, but the dog did not at once notice the noise. So absorbed was he in his prey. Again, Peter whistled, low and soft as before, with nothing menacing about it. Now the dog stopped and looked about. As Peter began moving towards the sheep, the dog retired. "Good pup! Good pup!" Peter called quietly. The dog raised his head and put his ears up. Then he turned and moved back a few yards, stopped again and watched Peter. For a moment he was plainly uncertain and wavered. His instinct told him to flee, but he was confused. Peter's voice had something in it that attracted him, that made him trust the man. "Good pup," Peter said softly. "Come here, pup. Come here." The dog looked on, puzzled. It was a large brown dog with white markings. There were many dogs like it in the hills, but this one was larger than almost any Peter had seen before. He was a young dog, and his fine coat and high condition showed that he had a good home. His dark eyes glinted brightly, then narrowed as Peter watched him, and seemed to slant very slightly like those of a fox. The dog's lower jaw fell, leaving the mouth just barely open, the teeth just visible, anticipatory. "Come here, pup," Peter called again. But the dog had made his decision. The man was his enemy, not to be trusted. He turned and started away, head and tail down. Peter thought he had got his first hint as he saw the dog start away to the southeast, not moving directly away from him, but obliquely. He wondered if that was the direction of its home. Then the dog changed its direction suddenly and started away to the north. To the north, there were 3 miles of flat, marshy land. If the dog went that way, Peter could keep him in sight until he reached the other bank of hills. But what then? The dog would dash across the hills and away before he could come up with it. But if it were only a feint on the dog's part, so much the better, having him in sight. So began the chase. The swift, young, vicious animal that had been the hunter now became the hunted, fleeing from the slow and plodding but ominous dark figure of the man, who was armed against the speed and cunning of the dog with only his years of experience of training and using and watching sheepdogs. The contest was not as unequal as it seemed. Peter, seeing that the dog was afraid of him, of all men probably, thought that that sooner or later that would give him an advantage. The dog was not easy to keep sight of in the rough, reddish, boggy land. At times all that gave him away was the bright white fur at the end of his full furry tail. Peter followed his first thought as to the direction of the dog's home and kept to the south. The dog moved along in a more or less parallel direction to him, going eastward but always remaining to the north, moving slowly, indirectly, lying down at times, at others reversing his course and going back in the other direction. In general, he moved eastward, and Peter's first guess seemed right. The two reached the high hills to the east at almost the same time. Peter knew the dog had two ways he could go then. To the northeast, beyond the hills, was a glen of small farmers who kept mostly sheep and only a few cattle. To the south, a broader valley of cattle and dairy farms. If the dog went to the north, Peter knew he could easily find him among the houses there, all of them poor hill farms like his own, the farmers well known to him. As he lost sight of the dog entering the hills, he headed for a knoll that would give him a view of the valley below to the south. A valley of well-drained clay land, an area of cattle more than sheep, of good crops of oats, barley, potatoes, carrots. He had few acquaintances there and little reason to go there. He had lost sight of the dog in the hills, but he had reached the knoll with a chance of locating him again. The sun had risen. The valley was below him. He sat down on a tuft of dry heather and dug out his pipe and tobacco and knife. He could easily lose the dog for good now. He knew he must follow it right to its home, or he could do nothing about it, even if he found it again later. As he smoked, he wondered what chance he would have of getting the price of his dead lambs. Men who could read and write had ways of doing things he knew nothing about. After a while, he saw the dog again, below him, possibly half a mile away. He restarted after it and could see that it was still following a broken path, not going directly towards its home. At times, it would stop under a low tree or a hedge and lie down. Then Peter would loiter too, but always trying to keep the dog in sight. Once out of the hills on the flatter land below, things became more difficult again. There was a road to follow here. But there were side roads, too, trees and hedges, houses, barns and ditches. The dog knew this ground, and Peter did not. Two or three times he lost sight of the brown fur, so long he thought the dog had got away from him. Then he would stop and look over the landscape patiently, his unshaven, gray-bristled face in that same relaxed attitude it always assumed when a problem presented itself to him. His eyes moved steadily from field to field, without haste, taking in no specific object, receptive to general impressions. Here all was green. There was no heather, and rushes were sparse. Most of the hay had been cut and won and put up in cocks, and a soft, light green aftergrass had sprung from the ground around them. The houses were large and prosperous-looking, without buildings and, in some cases, tall, round-roofed hay sheds. Fields of dark earth with yellow stalks of stubble indicated where barley or oats had stood and recently been cut. Cattle were grazing quietly. The morning was still early. Peter was now 6 miles or so from his farm, but no one here was up yet. So by irregular starts and stops, he followed the dog to a spot near a two-story house with a fine slate roof, well kept. This was a house Peter knew. The owner kept a large herd of cattle, which were grazing then in surrounding pastures. Peter had seen him at Mart's, even though they had never spoken. He seldom took a drink, Peter knew, and was famous for his tenacity in getting the price he wanted for his animals. Peter had never had any dealings with him. The dog had been lurking at the hedge that separated two farms. Peter watched him now as he moved forward from the hedge to a small tin-roofed shed built onto the byre. As he neared the shed, the dog moved more swiftly until, with a sudden leap, he rose and disappeared through a small window on the side of one wall. The dog had reached home. When he had seen the dog go into the shed, Peter saw no reason to hesitate, but went straight to the door of the two-story house and knocked loudly. A long while passed without any answer. Again he knocked, and a third time. Finally the door opened, and a heavy woman with matted dark hair that hung around a long, angular face broken into many flat planes and half-open eyes that showed only a suggestion of alarm behind their sleepiness looked out. She was still in her nightdress, an old raincoat over it, her feet in well-worn cloth slippers. She eyed Peter blankly, her look of curiosity, ready to receive some unknown alarm, changing rapidly to one of defensive but repressed indignation. She had never seen this man before, and her first reaction was mistrust. She did not put her questions in words, but stared steadily at Peter, and her hands shifted slightly sideways to let him know he should speak. "Is himself at home?" "Himself? What do you want?" Peter told her who he was, but he would not tell his business. The woman closed the door and Peter waited. After about a quarter of an hour, a large man, Peter's himself, opened the door and stepped out. In Ireland, the husband's always known as himself. Peter identified himself again, and the other nodded acquiescence, as if to acknowledge having seen him at the marts and being generally aware of who he was. He had not said a word, but his manner invited Peter to continue, and while Peter told him briskly about the killings, his face kept its same, not unfriendly look. Only when Peter had finished did a darkness come over the large man's face, in reaction to the new and unwelcome problem in his life at a busy time of the year. Then, looking at Peter for a moment, he finally spoke. "That dog's tied at nightfall," and without saying any more, he led the way to the shed Peter had seen the dog enter. He was only a few years younger than Peter, but tall and heavy, and his thick, large hands reminded Peter that he had heard it said that this man had milked 30 cows every morning and evening when he was young. Stopping at the door of the shed, he looked at Peter steadily, curiously, but his face was not set in a frown. Rather, there was something almost like a smile about his tightly closed lips. When the two men entered the shed, the dog, lying asleep, stirred and turned its head. Before it lay a chipped enamel wash bowl with bits of dried food sticking to the edges. The dog rose slowly and stretched, then put its nose into the bowl and licked the edges. At that moment, Peter noticed the chain. The large man looked at him without speaking. The dog was chained, the chain leading from a large stone to a leather collar around the dog's neck. Was only about 18 inches long. "That's the dog was after my sheep today," Peter said. The other bent downward to release the snap on the dog's collar and straightening again said, "Come in for tea. You have a good way to go." Pondering the event later, Peter had no doubt that he had the right dog. There was no mystery about the way he had come to be chained. Peter had often seen young pups working away at their collars until they learn to slip their heads out. Some of the cleverest of them would learn to put their heads back in again, but there was nothing he could do about the dog. The question remained, would it come back again? He was certain it had its freedom every night since the collar could not hold it. He kept his own dog tied by his bed at night. 3 weeks more passed without a sign of the killer dog. The meadow had been cut swath by swath with the scythe, and most of it was up in neat cocks, protected at the tops with crowns of a thick green thatch of rushes. Some of the hay was still in little rounded mounds, grasscock, Peter called them, or laps, because they were as much hay as a man or a woman could hold between his or her half-crouching thighs and the circle of his arms and hands, waiting for one more warm, sunny day to be shaken out for a final drying and built into regular cocks, then stacks. Finally, one morning when a fine drizzle was falling, Peter heard his dog fly whimpering impatiently beneath his bed. Dressing quickly and putting on an old tweed jacket, he went out. A mist made it difficult to see the hill. Going back for his stick, he went out again and quickly up to the crest of the hill and down the other side. There was no sign of the dog, and the sheep were quiet. He worked his way back to the crest, then eastward along it. He had been out almost an hour without any sign of the dog. Then for a moment the mist opened, and he saw the dog several hundred yards to the east on his neighbor's land. The sheep were not in a bunch as he had seen them before, but scattered, and the dog had caught a lamb. For a moment, Peter hesitated. If he set out now, at once, for the lowland farm, there was every chance that he would be there before the dog, and so prove that the dog was slipping his collar and away killing sheep. But how many more sheep would be killed if he left the dog alone? As the mist closed in again, he made his decision and headed for his neighbor's house. He called softly at a window of the thatch house, much like his own. For a moment there was no reply. Then came a low grunt Peter knew to be a question. "Come on," he said. "The dog's back. He's at your sheep. Handle him quiet. Don't put him away too quick. I would be there first if I could." Standing in his doorway, the large man looked at Peter again, harshly. "Back again," he said. "Your dog's up killing now. I left him and come straight here." The man looked at him for a moment, partially reflecting, partly clearing his still sleepy brain. The mist that covered the hills densely when Peter set out had not yet begun to lift even here on the flat countryside. The air was chilly. When he had pondered Peter's statement for a moment, the other man turned and went back into the house without closing the door, and Peter stood before the blank open doorway. Then he returned. He had put on an old dark tweed suit jacket and carried a shotgun. Opening the gun, he took a red paper cartridge from his pocket and, holding it for a moment above the breech, inserted it into the left-hand barrel, leaving the other empty. Glancing at Peter, he closed the gun. "If the dog's killing sheep, he'll be shot and you'll be paid for the sheep. But if the dog is there, you're trespassing on this farm, not for the first time." Saying this, he set his jaws together so that his jowls became prominent, and the white grizzle of unshaven hair on his chin seemed to catch the diffuse silver light of the morning mist. His heavy neck was creased and red under the wrinkled cotton shirt, and his whole figure emitted the feeling of a man still not far from an interrupted sleep. "You'll be trespassing on this farm," he repeated, moving the gun very slightly, "and looking to cause trouble." When he had said this, he gave no sign of further movement, but stood quite still in his own doorway, the shotgun in his large right hand, its muzzle indicating at the ground at Peter's feet. Peter looked at him. His mind tried to grasp the implied threat. Trespassing? The word was never used in the hills. Sheep moved back and forth over an area of miles, and farmers after them. No man objected to another passing over his land, nor should farmers here object. Peter was puzzled. The large man interrupted his thought. Will we go to the shed and see if the dogs there are away? He asked. Your dog's away killing, Peter asserted. Then, as the other looked at him again without reply, he realized that the dog could be anywhere, that he had not actually tracked the dog this time in the heavy mist, but simply cut out in a direct line for the lowland form, assuming the dog would stay behind. The other man watched him sharply. It's you who come here looking for trouble, he said. Peter hesitated again. A light drizzle, something between mist and rain, had begun to fall softly from the northwest, and Peter felt the soft, cool moisture settling on the side of his face and the outside of his hands. We'll go to the shed, he said. Telling about it later, he remembered how the drops of falling mist had settled on the large man's hair and old tweed jacket and the tiny glistening points of wetness that did not merge with each other or penetrate the surface they rested on, but shone back the light each individually in a sparkling display. Peter followed him to the shed. It, too, glistened with many distinct droplets of water along the roof and the green, moss-glazed stones of the north-facing wall. For a moment, the two stood side by side at the door as the man cocked the loaded left-hand barrel of the gun, then removed the rusty sardine tin key that held the iron latch in place and pushed open the door of the shed. In the gray, diffuse light emitted by the wet mist through the small square window, they could see, lying on the ground at the end of the short chain beside the old cracked porcelain bowl, the dog's empty collar. For a moment, neither man looked up. Peter cleared his throat and coughed. In the farmhouse kitchen, over tea and bread and butter, they quickly settled the price of the dead sheep. The large man took Peter's word for the number killed, but they bargained briefly over their value. He had a shrewd idea of what each of Peter's lambs would be worth that autumn, even without having seen them. Then he pulled a dense roll of wrinkled banknotes from his pocket and solemnly counted out the sum, note by note, adding some coins to bring the total to the amount agreed upon. Peter fingered each note slowly, tentatively. He was still working over the sum in his head, laboriously adding the price of each sheep, one by one, to the previous ones. Then he matched the figure arrived at by this slow addition to the money in his hand. Holding one of the coins in his large, blunt fingers, he seemed for a moment to be lost in some obscure and mysterious calculation. Suddenly he held out the coin. "There's the luck," he said. The other man took the coin. "What about the dog?" Peter asked. "You'll see him no more." Peter nodded. Looking out the window, he saw that the rain had stopped and the mist lifted. He looked at the money in his hand again. Folding it tightly, he pushed it well down into the inside pocket of his tweed jacket. He looked about for his stick, which he had left in the corner near the kitchen door. Taking it up again, he left. The rain had stopped. There was a peculiar warmth in the air for the lateness of the season. He was anxious to be home. Today would probably be the last chance to win the remaining hay. There would be good drying in it. His sister was probably already shaking out the grass cocks to dry. As he reached the foot of the hills, he felt a gentle breeze across his face. A shotgun sounded in the distance. Above him, two gray crows flying irregular courses in the air chattered loudly. As the haze thinned, a weak, pale sun could just be seen in the east. There you go. I think that's an excellent story. It is just so emblematic of life there. Yeah. An older life that well, at the rate things are going, maybe reclaimed a bit sooner than any of us think. But yes, happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Hear what's going on. Okay. Now, this is Pat Rabbit with Not for Public Consumption on a Thanksgiving in the year 2023, the year of the rabbit. It's going to be the year of the rabbit to February 12th. That's when the Chinese New Year is, and the next animal will be coming in. Is that Heather? No, that's a squirrel. No, I got to make sure that... Wait, no, that's Heather. Okay. His head sticking up in the air looked like a squirrel bending down with a tail in the air. His head looked like a squirrel's tail. He used to stay out of the street. But I see squirrels and birds, the singer will go after him. Boy, he just really starts hitting on them. Here we go. Run out and distract them. If I see it, gee, you know, there's so much I don't see. No. Thank you. Thank you, Lizzie Neal. Yeah, it is a good story. I think it's an excellent story. There is one here that I've been looking at. I don't think it's off. What is the title, though? I know I have it bookmarked, and it's probably still on the page, but I got to find the title. Let's see. No, this is not it. Okay, let's try again. Dun, dun, dun. A lot of flashback. Don't cry for Argentina. Please, but it may have just slipped off the page, and I got to go look in my bookmarks to find it. Let's see what my bookmarks are telling me. Let's see. What is those little noises, I wonder? I used to get breathing. Now I get static. It's weird. Oh. It's over the movement in Ireland. I want to get this novel. There's a article about it. It looks good. It was written back in the 80s or something, but it's an article about it here. Michael Nicholson, famine novel changed my mind on England's guilt in Ireland's famine. And the name of the novel is Dark Rosaline, and it's available on Amazon for about $10 used, good condition. So might have to grab that next. Yes, I heartily encourage everybody to read, because you don't know what you're missing if you don't read books. Really. Sometimes it's hard to read at night lately because I'm kind of sleepy when I lie down, and starting to read will just really do it. It'll do me in. But yesterday was... the 60th anniversary of JFK's death. 60 years, here's the headline, 60 years after JFK's death, it is more and more apparent that Kennedy was the victim of a palace coup spearheaded by Vice President Johnson, that evil son of a bitch. Yeah, he didn't help starting things off. And... bacteria store memories and pass them on for generations. What kind of memories? That's interesting. Okay, now I'm going to find that article. Where is it? Is this it? Yeah, this is it. I'll do it when next hour. It's entitled, What Have We Learned About Society Over the Last 3.5 Years? By Toby Rogers at the Utopian. Cute little pun. And there's a number of bullet points. Numbered, biggest day, writ large. So we're going to have a look at it. It's not long, but it's really to the point. I mean, a lot of these articles, a lot of this stuff we talk about, we watch it so much that any time we get on the air and hold forth about it, we ain't doing nothing but preaching to the crowd, preaching to the choir. We know this. Damn, we've been watching it all for years now. Who are we telling that doesn't know? I mean, newcomers? We'll see. Yeah, some newcomers, they start, you know, come straggling in and slowly picking up things in their own little ways, like we did. So, you know, best we can do is help them along. Of course, I know I did a whole lot of it in total blindness. I would sort of listen to stuff here, and I'd actually kind of take it to face value and think, hey, you know, this is the reality. And later on, I started going, no, I don't think so. No, this ain't true. So, oh boy. Yes, who we got? Bigfoot riding a T-Rex. Wee doggy. Yeah. Germ theory. Well, sure, you can stick dirt in a wound and it'll get. But, I mean, things always get so binary. Things are so it's terrain theory. No, it's germ theory. No, it's terrain. Well, how about somewhere in the middle? You're selecting good points of both, and then you're sticking one over here and the other over there, and you're setting them at variance and letting them loose against each other. That ain't no way to do it. Come on, man. Come on, people. Wake up. Get a grip. I'll be right back.
No secret that the so-called mainstream media is best described as controlled propaganda. Countless news stories are either totally ignored or spun with half-truths, and because of this, essential facts and vital information are often compromised. Join Dr. Ott every Friday night on Studio B at 10 p.m. Eastern and learn why The Story Behind the Story was nominated for a Peabody Award in its second year of producing unparalleled broadcasting excellence in 1997. That is, if you really care about learning the truth.
Things were not quite right, that everything was just ever so slightly askew.
Do you have, to paraphrase Morpheus, a splinter in your mind?
If you're interested in hearing the latest information about UFOs, the paranormal,
ancient cultures and structures,
monatomic elements,
longevity,
fantastic discoveries in science,
download it to your brain,
then tune in to us. Hi, I'm Dave.
And I'm Mackie.
And we are Shiny Side Out, Sundays 2 to 4 a.m. Eastern. See you then.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
check in every Thursday night for the Crypt Rick and Jonathan Show.
Studio A, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Right here at the number one listener-supported radio station, Revolution Radio.
The Secret Kindergarten is here for the young children of the world. The best program on the radio for kids. Dealing with the most important topics in the whole universe. Fairy tales, music and movement, numbers, plants, animals, fun, colors, insects. Take care and cast your ears out to catch a story from the world of other young things. Reach out, up, under, and over. Sing a song. Talk about feelings. Just remember the magic word. The magic word is no. Step on into the Secret Kindergarten. Saturdays, 2 p.m. to 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on Revolution Radio.
Are you interested in the paranormal? Murder mystery? Real natural law? Do you enjoy interviews with amazing guests? Then join Crypt Rick every Monday night, 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on Revolution Radio. Studio A, freedomslips.com. Crypt Rick's iPhone, thank you. Welcome to the Crypt.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
And it's Turkey Day. Here we are on Turkey Day at Revolution Radio. This is the halfway point, kind of. First you get Halloween, then you get Thanksgiving, and the next stop is Christmas. Unless you want to just smash it all together, Christmas and New Year, solstice. And they were all the same at one time. Christmas was the solstice, was the New Year. Was a little baby year. The true year didn't start till the spring equinox. That's when the year was really getting going. But in some cases. But anyway. Okay. Now, here's that article I had mentioned. Let's see. What have we learned about society in the last 3.5 years by Toby Rogers? He writes, it's really quite astonishing. Prior to COVID, I had a mental map of how society worked. COVID destroyed that picture. COVID reveals society as it really is, and it's shocking. Here's what I've learned about society over the last 3.5 years. Number one, the ruling class is psychotic. Isn't it ever? Bill Gates, Klaus Schwab, Albert Bourla, etc. take delight in killing people, cause carnage just to overcome their own hedonic adaptation, and are completely incapable of empathy or self-awareness. They have tremendous resources to shape society. And the technologies of persecution have become incredibly powerful. But these people are completely immoral, so they twist society into a hellscape that provides them with endless sadistic entertainment. Two, Our meritocratic institutions are almost entirely fraudulent. The Ivy Leagues sold the students in their care to the pharmaceutical industry and said nothing about the complete collapse of liberal democracy. The Nobel Prize Committee gave MVP awards to the inventors of the technology that created SARS-CoV-2 and the scientists who created the worst vaccines in human history. Tony Fauci, a mass murderer on par with Pol Pot and Stalin, routinely receives awards for defending science and speaking truth to power. None of these institutions are capable of independent thought at this point, which is surprising. These people are supposed to be smart, the best, but they are not. They are the opposite of smart. The intelligentsia are deformed, a claw fist permanently clutching a golden ring. 3. The American economy has always been based on genocide and is still based on genocide. Genocide of Africans via the Middle Passage. Genocide of indigenous people via Manifest Destiny. Genocide of the people of Guatemala, Vietnam, and Indonesia via neocolonialism. And now, genocide of everyday average Americans via vaccines. The way the global economy used to work was that white males in the U.S. and Europe enjoyed liberal democracy while militaries from these countries used violence to acquire resources and create markets in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. But now there are no new lands left to conquer, and so empire is colonizing the bodies, cells, and DNA of ordinary citizens in the U.S. and Europe. As before, the agents of empire claim that our bodies are terra nullius, it's a Latin term, and they have arrived to provide civilization. 4. Most people would rather die than think for themselves and risk being excluded from mainstream society. The TV told them to line up in stadium parking lots to be vaccinated, and so they did. They had an inkling that it was dangerous. Many didn't really want to do it, but the thought of being labeled an anti-vaxxer was more terrifying than the very real possibility of being disabled or killed by the shot. So they got the shot over and over again. These injections made no difference in stopping COVID. And now many of these people are dealing with lifelong injuries from this ridiculous junk science. It's true for autism, too. Many parents would rather have an autistic kid than get called an anti-vaxxer by their friends, neighbors, and colleagues. 5. We already live in the Matrix. People are already enslaved to a death cult. Television, social media, streaming services, and video games have an astonishing hold over people's minds and bodies right now. Add in DoorDash, Taco Bell, Domino's, alcohol, gambling, with nationwide in-game betting from one's phone for all specials, for all major sports. Porn and drugs, prescription and street, and America is already enslaved to a death cult more murderous than Jim Jones. Natasha Dow Schull, in her brilliant book, Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas, writes, "The mechanical rhythm of electronic gambling slot machines pulls players into a trance-like state they call the machine zone, in which daily worries, social demands, and even bodily awareness fade away. Once in the zone, gambling addicts play not to win, but simply to keep playing for as long as possible, even at the cost of physical and economic exhaustion. In continuous machine play, gamblers seek to lose themselves while the gambling industry seeks profit. And there's your quote, and the author says, hat tip to Matthew Crawford for mentioning this book. All electronic media is now based on this model. The Matrix reaches into nearly every home, pocket, and purse in America. Six, the two main political parties, Republican and Democrats, are amoral and only care about power. There are 535 members of Congress, only 20, less than 4%. All Republicans have even the faintest understanding of the iatrogenocide, death by doctors, that is all around us. Political parties exist to reproduce themselves. Elected officials only listen to donors. The larger the campaign contribution, the more they listen. Our political system is entirely transactional, a vending machine for the very wealthy with no sense of national purpose. Seven, allopathic medicine, public health, the WHO, FDA, CDC, and NIH are all broken beyond repair. Any centralized decision-making body can and will be captured by industry. So professional associations, medical societies, regulatory agencies, and standards of care are all captured and designed to produce maximum profits for pharma. The health of the patient be damned. Western allopathic medicine is presently constituted as the formalized practice of medical barbarism. Number eight, ideology creates reality. It's said so often that it's now a cliche. We interpret reality through the lens of ideology, worldview, assumptions, etc. But it's absolutely true. Think about this daily performance of ritual obedience. A vaccinated person gets COVID. Would have been worse without it. A COVIDian develops myocarditis after a shot. But getting COVID would have been even worse. A COVIDian gets a booster. Thank goodness for the updated shots. A COVIDian dies from the shot. Coincidence. The reality is that the shot doesn't work. It's toxic. It will never be a good match for a rapidly evolving respiratory virus, and it's deadly. But in every case, ideology supplies the believed reality that supplants the truth. I still think that there is an objective, noble reality. But holy heck, it is difficult to near impossible to get people to pay attention to it. Religion. Many Americans worship money, celebrity, pleasure, safetyism, junk science, power, the illusion of control, etc. Basically anything other than the divine. 10. But here's the good news. Personal conviction is the bulwark against tyranny. Clinical trial director Brooke Jackson became a whistleblower who revealed Pfizer's crimes. Iconoclast libertarian Jeffrey Tucker set up an independent think tank that quickly became a worldwide beacon of liberty. Warrior mom and web designer Liz Wilner and anonymous friends set up Open Veyers that gets more traffic than the CDC Wonder database. Corporate attorney Aaron Seary followed his conscience and built a law firm that is the best defender of liberty in the world. Chelsea Green, best known for books on organic farming and homesteading, published many of the foundational texts of the COVID resistance, including books from Karina Reese and Sukaret Bhakti, Matthias Desmond, and Naomi Wolf. Warrior Mom Amy Bone built Protection of the Educational Rights of Kids, PERK, P-E-R-K, into a grassroots legislative powerhouse that is now defeating bad bills in the bluest state in the country. Former Hollywood TV producer Del Bigtree created a medical freedom broadcast that now gets more viewers per episode than CNN. Not hard to beat CNN these days. Documentary filmmaker Stephanie Spear created the Defender for Children's Health Defense that now has more readers for COVID coverage than the New York Times. New York real estate attorney Bobby Ann Cox convinced the New York Supreme Court to strike down the New York State Department of Health quarantine camp policy. There are thousands more examples like this from the past few years. Please add your favorites to the comments. The ingenuity of the resistance is unparalleled. The more I think about it, the more remarkable this story is. In response to COVID, Harvard, Princeton, and Yale failed. The FDA, CDC, and NIH failed. MSNBC, CNN, and Fox News failed. The New York Times, Washington Post, and Economist failed. The AAP, AMA, and ACOG failed. But that, we know, has a reason. That is because of an agenda called globalism, which is entitled The Great Reset. Of course they're going. That's the woke direction, but whatever, we will continue. And a bunch of Americans who most people had never heard of rushed to the barricades and thus far have fought the fascist farmer juggernaut to a standstill. We still have a long way to go, but these stories of individual heroism in the face of pharma tyranny are incredible. Oh dear, this article started out red pill, then went black pill, but ended up white pill. Such is the emotional journey of a resistance fighter. Hey, that needs to be a flag. Whose flag is red on top, black in the middle, and white on the bottom? Or maybe the other way around. I don't know. I have to look. Or if someone knows, you can tell me. Blessings to the warriors. Prayers for everyone fighting to stop the Iatra genocide. Huzzah for everyone building the alternative economy our hearts know is possible. In the comments, please let me know what you have heard about society over the last 3.5 years or anything else that is on your mind. As always, I welcome any corrections. Yes, and I agree with the writer. I'm wondering if Toby is a female, because the name Toby can be female as well as male for a nickname. Was kind of writing like a female, I thought. Anyway, let us see. Let's see what we got here. No. Here's something that was given to me. To change the general feel of things. It's entitled, and this is from Tim Sanders. It's entitled, Let's Make Every Day Thanksgiving. I have to say that Thanksgiving is one of my favorite holidays of the year, not because of the turkey and football, but because of the gratitude it triggers in so many. Excuse me. The day is a celebration of thinking abundantly and sharing our gratitude with those we appreciate. While it's the perfect day for gratitude to abound, it shouldn't be the only one. We should celebrate Thanksgiving 365 days a year. We should. Indeed, I agree. 20 or so years ago, while I was living in Dallas, I worked at a company where the president had an annual tradition of buying everybody turkeys, closing shop at lunch on Wednesday and giving us a long weekend to celebrate. I was mulling around the break room the day before Thanksgiving, and I asked our new employee, Joe, how he and his family planned on celebrating. What he said next stopped me in my tracks. We celebrate Thanksgiving every single day in our house. He went on to He went on the explain. I think he meant to write. He went on to explain that he had recently relocated his family from a dangerous neighborhood to one close to our office after getting the job. Instead of worrying about the next meal or being a victim of crime, every day they had all they needed and felt safe. So for him, Thanksgiving was really for the rest of us, those that needed such a reminder to feel grateful. That conversation reminded me of something my grandmother Billy always said. Gratitude is a muscle, and if you don't work it out, you'll get spiritually flabby. She believed that we needed to find time every morning to give thanks as a way of exercising our gratitude. Why is gratitude so important? First of all, it's a boost to your health. According to a study conducted at UC Davis, where those who made a practice of integrating gratitude into their routine enjoyed better moods and experienced far fewer physical ailments. For your attitude, consider gratitude a tonic that will help you get along better with others, overcome adversity, and be more generous. Or as one taxi driver told me, gratitude will get you a gracious attitude. Here's my point. Make every day Thanksgiving by integrating action into your life that reminds you of how much you really have. In my book, Today We Are Rich, I shared a morning routine that only takes a few minutes and will lock your mind into the people, opportunities, and experiences that enrich your life. To celebrate Thanksgiving with a gift for you, I've created a short excerpt from the book that details my morning gratitude exercise that you can download and read here. Recently, I ordered a few thousand copies of Today We Are Rich so I could offer boxes of gratitude and abundance to my friends at a great price. The book chronicles the life and teachings of Billy King Kaufman and the seven principles of total confidence she raised me with. I'm happy to sign each one personally to your friends and loved ones and ship them directly to you. Some of my associates have been giving this out as gifts to clients, and others are spreading it around their friend circle to boost everyone's abundant mentality and resiliency. Reply to this message or contact me if you like pricing, and I'll get right back with you. Another way to think of gratitude is an engagement lever with those you work with. Showing your gratitude to your teammates and employees gives them a boost of energy. It's one of three things you can do to lift performance every Monday. Watch this video for more. Yeah, that was nice. Yes, gratitude is so important. Yeah, I find that every time I find the time to be thankful for everything I have, everything, I am in a better place than I was when I was. It's always important to remember this, and you do that by training yourself. It's an exercise in just training. Remember to do it. Remember to do it. It turns into a little ritual, but that's okay. There's a place for rituals if you understand them. And it's the mental thrust of it, not so much as the physical thrust or the donning of raiment and doing ceremonies. I don't necessarily mean that when I say ritual. Not at all. So, yes, Thanksgiving. Thomas Sayers was saying something really interesting on the show last night on their show, Thomas and Dagny, Intel Warriors, talking about the origin of Thanksgiving. And it is not really a bunch of pogroms and Indians. You know, the pogroms, they sailed in the Mayflower and they landed at Plymouth Rock and they built themselves a real socialist, communist colony, the Pogroms. I changed the name, you may have noticed, from Pilgrim to Pogrom, because it's about what it means. And I think they were aiming for Jamestown, and maybe we should be great. We should have gratitude and give Thanksgiving. They missed. and wound up in Massachusetts, Plymouth Rock instead. I've seen Plymouth Rock. I've been there. But anyway, yeah, and then they ran up with the Indians and had a big celebration of corn and fish and turkeys and gave Thanksgiving for I'm not sure what for. I don't know, some sort of truce so they weren't fighting with each other or God knows what it was. I'm not really sure. But no, but it was something that was in Congress. And it was like in the 1780s or something like that. And they had voted on making a Thursday in November a day to give thanks for everything. Thanks. In particular for being the country where we erected the Constitution. And they say that all men are created equal. They are not. No, that's the wrong way to interpret it. The way it's... Nothing is equal. Not all men, not all anything. Nothing is equal. Everything is different. Everything. No, what that means is all men are equal in the eyes of God and in the eyes of the law. Or at least it should be that way. In the best of worlds, it is that way. In reality, it isn't. You know, there's always so much you could be, so many ways you can be looking at it. And, yeah. There on A, that's because I'm on B mechanic. The neighbors are always fighting, are they? Is that some kind of a metaphor, or is that reality where you live? That is my question. Yes, the metal rabbit is on B. I'm holding forth with philosophy and metaphor and allegory and all those good things so we can all understand everything. What I really like to try to get people to do is to always take the 80 to 100,000 foot view. Always get that high up so you can see everything. See the biggest picture possible. That's a real Leo thing. I'm not a Leo. I'm a Cancer, but I have Venus and Pluto and Leo, and maybe that's where I get it. But, yeah, see the big picture. Because when you do that, it has an added advantage of allowing you to see the truth. It allows you to talk to more people more easily. There is a common denominator, and as long as the common denominator is a good one, because for every bad common denominator, there is a good common denominator. And seek to find that one and seek to employ that one. And I think you'll be good. Now, let's see. What is my phone doing? Oh, yes. Your old DSP is telling me we see you've been eyeing Archetype Pliny X or Pliny 10. I'm not sure. They're having a Black Friday to November 30th, and I've been stashing my pennies off to the side because there's this one plug-in I will grab. I'm going to grab it. Even though I'm spending so much time with the fiddle and everything, I haven't forgotten my guitar. It's right here beside me. I even pick it up sometimes. And this is going to go into my studio because this is an amp simulator, and it's a plug-in, and it's incredibly nice. And Per Nielsen of this Swedish band, who's an incredibly good guitarist, he uses it too. He loves it. He records albums using it. That one and Granifier, which will be the two that I own. The DSP Granifier, which is an amplifier, which is, whoa, you like heavy metal. If you like those heavy metal sounds, well, it's right there. And then the Pliny is just some amazing sounds right through it, including some metal. Now, Pliny is this guitar player from Australia who came to the public's attention some 5 years, 6 years ago or so. And I even tried you can get any of their plugins for free for 2 weeks. And so I tried Pliny for 2 weeks, and I liked it a lot. But I just didn't feel like paying $195 for it. It was $100, it's gone up to $120 now that it's Pliny X, because they upgraded it. Hey, Doc, how you doing? Happy Thanksgiving to you. Thank you, too. Thank you for being here. And so now it's Pliny X, and they want $120 for it. I mean, we're getting into the expensive ones, like the John Petrucci for $160, is it? I don't know. Is it $145? Getting up there. Well, I'm a past customer, so I get a few dollars off. But still, I wasn't going to pay $95 for it. No matter how good it is, I'm not paying that much for a plug-in. But I will give them 60. So, there we go. Yeah. So I'm going to grab that before the 30th. They keep sending it because I keep eyeing it. And then next thing you know, I get a little text from them. We see you've been eyeing Pliny X. Yep, I have been. And I have to further fill the airwaves with miscellaneous borscht or whatever you want to call it. I've been making some. I've been trying to find the perfect chin rest. This is a hard search on a fiddle. Has there anything to do with how you hold the fiddle? How long your neck is? How thick it is? How you're built, you know, and I'm built fairly solid, you know, and my neck's not real long. It's not about medium. And so I get this one, and I've been wanting to get more boxwood chin rest because I like them because they're the lightest lightweight. They're light color, but they're lightweight, which I like the best. You got ebony, which is your bowling ball style weight-wise, and then you got the rosewood, which is medium. Then you got the boxwood, which is the lightest weight ones. Very pretty, too. You know, you see those light-colored chest pieces, they're made of boxwood. They carved the boxwood. So I got the Orin Farm, the Berber, which is something of an ugly duckling, but it's very comfortable in its own way, yet I have decided it is too tall. And it doesn't fit the fiddle because of the type of tailpiece I'm using or whatever, but it's not really fitting good in a way that I'd like to see things fit. It's not snug and proper. I'm weird like that. Then I ordered a Flesch. These are German names, Berber Flesch. F-L-E-S-C-H. And it goes right over the tailpiece instead of to the left side of it. And strange to say, I'm going to digress here. On some of the very, very ancient violins, some of the old Garnieris and Stradivarius from the 1700s, you'll see a shadow mark where a chin rest was on it for a very long time, and the light hitting the varnish was protected by the rest, and as a result, it left a mark of where the rest was. Curious enough, they were putting chin rests back then to the right of the tailpiece, which is really weird. I don't know, man. It's a strange way to hold a fiddle. There's a picture of Neil Gow holding a fiddle like that. And, damn, that's got your hand really twisted. You get that fiddle, you know, it's more like, let's bring it down more, slightly more like holding a guitar, at least a little, because you're going to hold it with your chin. You're clamping down between your chin and your shoulder. But it's a magical combination of the chin rest working with the shoulder rest. And that's what you have to figure out works best for you. So I figured out these two new ones are too high. And I tried the Tekka, which my plastic Tekka is not as high as the wooden Tekka that I have. And the wooden Tekka is prettier. It's a rosewood one, but it's too high too. There's something weird about the slant. And I'm always going back to my Dresden. My pretty little rosewood Dresden. And it's off to the side, though you can get one clamp on the center block, which is good to have because that's a stronger clamping point. And so then I'm going, well, let's see. Maybe it's the shoulder rest. So what I did, I can raise the height on the shoulder rest. And on my Kuhn Super, which is like, you know, approaching 30 years old, I'm going to need to get another one. And I'm going to get one of those, I think. Because there's a bunches of others, but none of them have the pitch adjustment. They got the width, they got the height, that's all good, but I want the pitch. They don't have pitch on them. Well, the Kuhn Super does. But anyway, I brought the height up, and I put the fiddle up, and wow, bingo. I need a low rest like the Dresden, so I'm going to order a boxwood Dresden. And I'm going to try a boxwood Baran, which is, the Dresden is 20 millimeters high, and the Baran is 22. So that I should be safe. These other guys are like 27, 28 millimeters high. They're almost 3 centimeters. They're too high off the top of the fiddle. And it's really weird, but when you have a lower chin rest, you hear the fiddle better. I think it raises, because literally it's raising the fiddle closer to your ear in a way that I like to hear it. On these other chin rests, it's, hey, down there. and the sound is a little different because of that. That, whatever. So that's next on the agenda. I might even have enough money to get an order started before I run out. oh, I won't run out. It's just getting to the bank to put more in. But I may have enough in the bank to get an order started before the first of the month. Okay, now, let's talk astrology, because I jumped right into the story. The sun went into Sagittarius yesterday. That's all well and good and to be expected. And the sun has just cleared a perfect square with Saturn. The sun is now at 1 degree, 12 minutes of Sagittarius. And Saturn is 0 degrees, 50 minutes, or 51 minutes of Pisces. That is a square. All right, sun, square, Saturn. This produces individuals who are very serious in life. They like to see you be able to measure things. Logic is their fort. It's their strong suit, is logic, their métier. If you can't weigh it, if you can't measure it, it don't exist. It makes doctors, it makes scientists. My dad was a doctor. He had a sun square Saturn. Okay? All right. That's good enough. Now, the moon is in Aries. Halfway through Aries. It's not particularly doing anything. It's going to come up to oppose Venus this afternoon later. That's mildly nice. I like that. Let's look at Mars. It's Mars that is concerning me right now. Mars is at 29 degrees and 32 minutes of Scorpio. It's in the 30th degree of Scorpio, which means it's fixing to enter Sagittarius. The sun just made a conjunction. Now, let's take a look at Saturn again. Remember, Saturn at 0 degrees of Pisces in 51 minutes. As soon as Mars hits 29 and 51 minutes of Scorpio, maybe 52, because Saturn is moving, albeit slowly, we're going to have an actionable square between Mars and Saturn. This will start perhaps tonight sometimes, definitely by tomorrow. The square will be perfect on Saturday the 25th. It'll be holding through the 26th. Mars square Saturn is the bête noire of astrology. Bête noire is French for beast of the night. In other words, it's the worst possible aspect you can imagine. Aspect meaning angle between two planets. That's a dog man at your door. There's Mars square Saturn. It's not good. You don't want Mars square Saturn. Get that baby out of here. And by the way, while it is, don't get out of bed. With the world situation the way it is, I would keep a weather eye on events. With a little luck, we can cruise through this and nothing big will happen. But see, Mars says go. Saturn says stop. It's a train wreck. It's a steam train hitting a rock wall. The steam train is moving. That's Mars. The rock wall is Saturn. What happens? Tremendous crash. Well, people born with Mars, Saturn can have god-awful tempers, a tremendous frustration. They also can have an amazing ability to wield things, Mars, in reality, Saturn, so they can become very, very good at whatever it is they're doing. So that's the higher side of it. I've seen both. It can be marvelous, but it can be god-awful, too. So, bear that in mind. It's coming on Saturday. It'll be perfect. It'll swing into actionable distance by tonight, probably. We're in on it now, so let's not put too fine a point on the actual times, because it'll be coming. And I don't mean to put too fine a point on it myself, but at the same time, there it is. Let's be aware of it. And we can take it from there. Now remember, we're an entirely user-supported station, and so we need your help. All you listeners out there, more who are not in the chat room than who are, I would suspect, because we push ourselves out over so many different outlets. It's hard for us to know just how many listeners we have. We can look at TalkStream Live and see how well we're doing, and typically we can do pretty well. As an internet station, we're generally always in the top 20, I think. Sometimes we're in the top 10, and every now and then we're in the top 2 or 3, maybe even number 1, depending on who's on. So, that's all good. So, bearing that in mind, be that as it may, let us give thanks for our presence. And as a result of that gratitude, fork over a little cash to help us keep going. Because remember, we're not enthralled to any corporation. We don't do anything according to what they want. It's easy to do. Just go to the main page, hit donations, and have a gander. You can figure that one out. You know, we say fascism is ruled by corporations. Yeah, but who, what are the corporations? It's people. And these are very, very, very wealthy people. Obscenely so. Wealthy in ways that should never, ever, ever be allowed to happen. Ways that have happened because something went wrong. And most of them, for most of them, this is ill-gotten. But these are the ones. And it's people who, by dint of their insane, immense wealth, assume that this gives them a right to rule things and decide how things go. For the rest of us, the great unwashed, as more and more of us are looking like, and the middle class becomes like dinosaurs. Well, here we are. So, oh boy. I don't like to be a black pill. I really, really don't like to be a black pill. Though I must say that when I black pill, there is always a silver lining on my black clouds. Assuming we come through things. Because at the rate I see things going, I don't see any fixing this. And I hope I'm wrong. God knows how much I hope I'm wrong. But the way these people are pushing forward with everything, and everything is so shaky over in the Middle East and in Russia. Russia's watching this. They know. They see. And I think there's tremendous misunderstanding with regard to the picture that can be seen if you get to 80,000 feet. I hear people say things that leave me going, huh? What are you really saying here? Do you really even know what you're saying? Now, a person's standpoint, to me, ought to be reflected in their speech, what they have to say, if they feel like letting you know. But sometimes they'll say things that make you think that, wait a minute, they don't have the real picture here. There's a narrative on one side, and there's the real picture on the other. There's all sorts of weirdness in between. But America, this sounds horribly cynical. Horribly, horribly cynical. But I was thinking the other day that we should change the national anthem for this country to "The End" by the Doors. Because that's about where we are in this country right now. Things have been so destroyed. This is a tragedy. A republic, madam, if you can keep it. Well, It's that keeping it which may result in some lively action, might I say, euphemistically, without, again, putting too fine a point on things. I mean, we can all see it. Come on. It's not like I gotta say anything. It's not like I gotta tell you. We must needs all be on the same page. Oh, wait. Someone's knocking at my door. I'll be right with you. Oh. I'm back. That was a Thanksgiving dinner. Just came to my door. Homemade will be very good. Oh, I love these. Bless Brother Bob. He's such a sweetie. Ah, okay. Yes, yes. A chink of reality. Okay. Now, I was yammering on about something. Now I gotta see if I can resurrect it. I got a few minutes left. Yeah, what are we gonna do? People get things wrong. Not often. And I don't know. I have to be careful myself because, you know, hopefully like other people, I don't speak up too loud, too fast. To say, wait a minute, man, what are you saying here? No, there's an art to it. There really is. To get to where people are. See what's going on. Assuming I see, but believe me, I'm very faithful with my intake of information. And I only get it from what I consider to be the best sources. There's a lot of clickbait out there. Most of the clickbait I watch is like Dogman and Bigfoot. Fun things, you know. Anecdotes, stories of weird things that have happened to people out in the woods. And hey, who's to say it's not true? Some of it I'm sure is bullshit, but I don't believe all of it is. And even the bullshit stuff is going to be essentially correct in the details, is they're just making up the story. It never happened, but what they're describing is correct. So, it's just having a good handle on that sort of thing. So, yes. I mean, what's going on today? Let me just check something. I get behind on Alex and Alexander. Let's see. Alex Cristoforo said, Wilders wins. Who's wins? Who's Wilders? I'm not sure yet. Orban wins a change. Biden, secret cell, Gaza deal. Nord Stream, state terrorism. Okay, that's his headlines and his little descriptive blurbs. And then for Alexander Mercurius, I got Ukraine, hard day, I'll say. Avdiivka cauldron. Kherson Bridgehead cut off. Wilders wins. Biden bricks Gaza plan. Biden is such a disaster. But it's not even, I mean, you might think they would use a different puppet. It's like a thumb in the eye, you know, using Biden for president. Because we know it's, you know, Obama behind him and all the communists. Our big bunch of friends, the communists in the State Department. Newland and Sullivan and Blinken and Obama and a few others. These people are just, they're nauseating. They're truly nauseating. This insane narrative that anybody in their right mind knows that's impossibly wrong, cannot be, will never be. And they're just, you know, shoveling billions of dollars. Of course, you know, these are not all banknotes. They're just digits on a computer. So how much is really there value-wise is to be seen. And so much being laundered in Ukraine, going back into the pockets of the guys in Washington, the rich men north of Richmond, and also into the pockets of the crooks in Ukraine, too. Ukraine is the most corrupt country in Europe. Following in Big Daddy America's footsteps is what it's doing. It got westernized. Ukraine got woke. That's what. And look at all these places, Georgia and all these other places, you know, where you know the CIA wants to kick off color revolutions. And you see the kids, and then they're all woke, and they're trans people, and they're all full of lip filler. And, oh, this lip filler thing is really unbelievable. Duck lips. Man, that's really big over there in some of these places. Thank God it's not in Russia. But in Ukraine, it's horrible. I mean, these people, they don't even look like humans. When you look at them, I'm going, damn, is that a model for beauty? I don't understand it. I don't get it. But that's just me, you know. I'm old. What do I know? I'm not hip. Not anymore. The world's no longer my oyster. It was at one time, maybe, but it's not now. Maybe that's good. I tend to think it is. I'm going to make the best of it anyway. So coming up after me will be Willow Andreessen. She's getting ready to go. She's warming up her mic. Checking the studio, making sure everything is ready. She will be on A. And then on B after me, if they're on, because on a day like today, we don't care if they're there or not. It is host's choice. And if there are some hosts who want to take advantage of free studio time because someone else isn't on, well, that's just fine, too. Let's have fun. Let's never forget to have fun. Life ain't worth living if you forget to have fun. So I say that. Well, coming up after Mona, assuming any of these people are on, who do we have? Do we have someone who is finally stuck in after Mona on Thursday? We might. Where is Christine? Isn't she on coming up? Let me take a look here, just so I... On Thursday, on A, after Willow, it is open. Then we'll have Liberation Nation with Deacon John and Duke Guy. And Jacker was collecting chickens yesterday because of a windstorm. I hope he found them all. Then after that, we'll have Cryptic and Jonathan. Then we'll have at 8, New American Dream. And then at 10, we'll have the mini Ice Age conversations with David Devine and New American Dream Boys with Chuck Gregory on before that. Then on B, we will have Mona Radler. And then we will have from 4 to 6, we will have Who Has Believed Our Report with Frank Martino and Christine Korda. Then we'll have it at 8, we'll have This, That, and the Other with Mario. And then, at 6, pardon me, not at 8, at 6. At 8, we'll have Reality Extraction with Mr. Rowe, and then the Center Path Matrix Wars with J. Charles Parker. And after that, we know it's anything's in the pipeline. Up for grabs, it's round tables, who's there? Sometimes the hosts are regular, sometimes they're not. The regulars and the irregulars are going to town here on this station. Hey, yes, yes. My patter runs, doesn't it? Yes. Hi, Bill. And Bill is on tomorrow night. He's on tomorrow night at 8 on A. Avail yourself of a great show and learn the truth about law and the truth about law-fi. Because there is a lot of law-fi out there, law fiction. A lot of what is said just is not so. And these people saying this stuff, they gin up lots of followers. And the story given is weaved so well that it's hard. I mean, it's easy to buy. You've got to, and that's the problem with misinformation, disinformation. A lot of these guys are just in it for bucks. They're not even on the shields for the New World Order or anything. They're just bullshitters is what they are. So that's just what we have to bear in mind. And I'll be back next week, same time, same place, and I'll have a regular show. And Willow's going to knock us back with something coming up. And we'll see malinformation. There you go. That is what it is, Bill. And a maladroit. I hear the music. Y'all take care. Be well. Be good. God bless. Take care. Fat Rabbit signing off.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
We did not engage in conflict that was out of line with our mission.
Is it disloyal? Is it sedition? Is it treason to oppose the hand of tyranny? Never!
I will never send troops anywhere on a mission of that kind without telling them that if somebody shoots at them, they can darn well shoot back.
I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty! Oh, give me!
A dark cloud is finally lifting across the world as U.S. military intelligence and their global partners are destroying the deep state criminal power structure that has ruled over our planet for hundreds of years.
We are free with the God-given rights, and we shall not yield that right to any power on earth.
Hi, I'm Scott McKay. The world is at, and I am your host on The Tipping Point. On Revolution Radio, where every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, we bring you the latest in this ensuing takedown of this global criminal empire.
That's an image of strength.
You'll get the raw, hard truth here on The Tipping Point. So come join us Mondays, 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern, in Studio B at...